Welcome to this episode of the Strong Kind Podcast. This episode is with Quentin Willie. He goes by Coach Q. This was a great episode. If you are an athlete, if you are a rehab practitioner, if you're just somebody who wants to listen to two dudes talk about pain and philosophy and training for a little while, this episode is for you. Had a great discussion with Coach Q. We talked about the rehab space and how tricky it can be to work in it, and how often the flashy or the sexy stuff is not necessarily what actually helps people. We talked about pain and recovery and good training. We also got into Coach Q's athletic background near the end, and we had a really good discussion on continuing to train and be athletic and have fun throughout the lifespan. Really enjoyed this conversation with Coach Q. I hope you enjoy it as well. You can find him at Coach_Q_Physio on Instagram. Please reach out to him with any questions and if you need guidance on rehab or training from a guy who knows what he's talking about. Thanks so much for being here. Hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks. So the whole reason I started this is because somebody else had me on theirs and they're like, this is my first episode. And I'm like, how many episodes do people usually get to? And they're like, most people, like 95% of people don't get to episode 2. And I'm like, oh shit, that's a super low bar. And like me, I'm like, if I can just get slightly above that, I'm good. And this will be, I think, your episode 63. So nice. I'm also just a big believer in like, just be persistent and having conversations. I just like having conversations with people. Like, you know, it's kind of funny because this comes on the heels. Okay, so Quentin, just introduce yourself to the audience and like tell us who you are. And but you've undergone a big life change. So that's kind of one of the reasons that it's cool to have you on too.
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Quentin. Everybody just calls me Q. I've never been called my actual name, I guess, my whole life pretty much. But yeah, so just Q. I'm a physical therapist, a strength coach, an exercise physiologist. That's where I kind of started, was going down the rabbit hole of exercise physiology. Thought I was going to do a PhD in that. Learned very quickly that while research is really, really cool, the craft and the art of doing the research involves a lot of very quiet time behind walls and behind computer screens, and that wasn't for me. And so I transitioned into a little bit more person-centered and person-facing type clinical things. Working as a strength coach primarily, and UNC. So I was with basketball, men's and women's basketball, and head strength coach there, Jonas, he says, hey, you know, getting a master's degree is great, but if you have the opportunity to or the chance to, I would go get some kind of a medical degree because, you know, I've been doing this for 2 decades and I still have to answer to medical folks that probably don't really know a whole lot about training. And I'm having to like justify what I do, but it would be really great to have people in the weight room or in the athletic setting or around more frequently that had medical lingo and language and knowledge, but also could train and knew about training to kind of help us communicate and work together a little bit better. So that's why I went to PT school. I was a strength coach for 2 years and it was like, well, this seems like a cool way of leveling up my strength and conditioning coaching ability is going to PT school. I think in grad school before PT school, so when I was getting a master's in exercise physiology, I just got exposed to some really great people. I shared a desk with Greg Knuckles from Stronger by Science, if anybody knows who that is. And that was a really pretty life-changing experience, to be honest, just being around him and gleaning so much information from him. And then he introduced me to Derek Miles, which is a PT. At the time, he was at Stanford Children's and with Barbell Medicine. And I think those two individuals really catalyzed my learning curve in what I would eventually end up learning and taking away from PT school, and the career path that I followed and the way that I treat in general is very, you know, more of an active approach and working my way up to working with athletes. But they just challenged everything constantly. All the things that I thought I knew from the strength and conditioning world, they just constantly challenged me on it. And that was great. And I'd say that made PT school really challenging though. Really, really hard. I was a very frustrated PT student, constantly called into the principal's office, so to speak, for challenging professors and challenging ideas and you know, they didn't like that very much. And, you know, it was tough. It was really tough being on clinical rotations where as a student, and I didn't know everything, obviously, but a lot of my CIs, not all of them, but there were a few early on in the PT school realm that just were really, really undershooting the mark of what I felt like PT could be. And that was really hard because obviously you're the student, you don't know anything. And so finding places to be humble amid like really subpar care, that was tough a little bit, but you know, we made it through. And I know that a lot of other students deal with that as well, that they come in from being a strength conditioning coach. And then all of a sudden they're in PT school and they're like, oh my God, this is not at all what I was expecting. This is terrible. And, anyways, you'll get through it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of like the existential crisis of, I think, a lot of students, even like me. I just was aware of barbell medicine. Like, I had coached CrossFit prior to school, and like, you know, CrossFit's not the most sound training methodology, but it's still like very much like get people moving and see what happens, which is honestly not that bad, right? And so like even just getting into school, I was just I you know, it was really awesome to learn a lot. And I think I went to Iowa, and there is a big critical thinking component of it, but you're still teaching to the test. You're teaching so that we can pass the board examinations. And then on clinicals, it's like, you know, like manual therapy-esque stuff constantly, because that's just, it's kind of been the norm for so long. And it like definitely, you know, was, I just kind of went along to get along, but I didn't always love it. And I actually just posted on this yesterday. Like, that sent me into an existential spiral shortly after my career started, where I was like, what the hell am I doing? And like, what are my values? And so it's tough, because like, we want to help people. And when you see people not being helped in the ways that you think they could be, it's tricky, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think every PT, I mean, and I think this probably transcends a lot of other industries and fields, but yeah, you go to school for XYZ reasons. Usually one of those reasons is to help people. You just want to do the most good. And a lot of PTs that end up going to PT school are folks that came from an injury history or background themselves. Yeah. A lot of students who pursue PT had a positive experience with PT themselves, or a pretty traumatic injury that led them to, you know, a number of rehab scenarios, and they just wanted to be able to turn around and give back. And so if that's where you're coming from, having positive experiences, maybe with part of the PT, feeling like you benefited so personally, like that's a big part of your identity now. As, and then you pursue a PT degree, which is a ton of investment. Yeah. Right. I mean, you got to invest a lot of time and a lot of money and take a lot of risk, knowing that on the back end, you're probably not going to come out making a whole lot of money. So like, people that want to do PT are generally pretty invested, I would say, whether that's invested from a academic and logical standpoint, or even if it's just a personal pursuit and meaningful thing for their life, you know, either way. So then to go through all that, and then to have like huge changes and existential challenging things come, like that can be pretty rattling. But I think, you know, we're better for it. And I would really honestly like challenge yourself, lean in to those crises, because you're only going to be better on the tail end because of it. And all the things that you were taught in PT school, all the things that, you know, maybe you were even taught at your first clinics, and all of the, you know, isn't this just common knowledge type things, like getting to the epistemology of why you believe what you believe and how you arrived at that truth, like lean in hard, because you're going to be better for it on the back end.
Yeah. That was always just like something I just like, I'm a why person. Like, why are we doing this? What, like, you know, so much of, I was just literally like thinking through, 'cause I saw, you know, and it's well-meaning, but it was like these exercises, like, you know, and they're the classic core stabilization stuff. Like, these are what helped me get through my back pain. And, but I'm like, literally, and I'm not telling anybody this, I'm just like ruminating in my brain. It's like, you could literally get the same benefits from walking, from riding a bike, from, you know, just starting with simple, like normal quote unquote movements, like, you know, squatting and XYZ, right? And it's so hard because beliefs are so just easily ingrained, right? Like, our default is confirmation, right? And that's why so many things are tricky. And when you go into, like, you know, your institution as a student, it's like you shouldn't be viewed as somebody, even if you're just asking questions. Like, the amount of questions that I asked that were basically like, why can't we just, like, strength train? People will be like, well, they're not ready to strength train. I'm like, well, like, what does that mean? Right. And so it's tricky. And I think part of it is just being okay with maybe being an outlier, right? Or just having those questions and, like, kindly, you know, kindly continuing to move forward and disagree. And then ultimately, wherever you get, like, if you work for yourself or if you work in a clinic, it's just like, you're going to be allowed, hopefully, to have your own treatment style, right? Maybe not. There's a lot of places that you kind of can't, and that sucks, but make the most meaning out of it. And that's a big piece of it as well. So that's a segue. Cause are you like leaving? Are you going into private practice?
Yeah. I'm doing more just private stuff right now. I mean, I would say I'm fairly open to working in professional or college settings. But I think I more or less saw behind the curtain and didn't like what I saw. And yeah. So, you know, call that an existential crisis again, for me, you know, but yeah, transitioning away from working in the quote unquote, the elite sport world and going into more private.
Is it, we don't have to get too deep into the nitty gritty of this, but is it more, cause you did post on your story, just like the perception versus the reality. Is it just like having the wealth of knowledge and like feeling like you can contribute and then just basically like it, like that the, my perception has always been like, in the pro and collegiate world, like you are like the hands-on guy, like you are the feel good type of person, and like the PT is the feel good type of person. And if you don't want to do those things, that like that setting is not necessarily where you want to be. Is that where it's at, or is it other stuff too?
Yeah, I would say a lot of it is that. I think, you know, most of the field just historically has been a lot of hands-on, like you said, mm-hmm. and a lot of the strength coaches and other people in that setting, you know, they'll even ask you like, oh yeah, you got to be good. Are you good with your hands? You know, how good are you with your hands? And it's like, how good am I with my hands? What are you talking about? Like,
yeah,
you know, it's what's between my ears that you should really be concerned about. And like my ability to think and reason through problems and like understanding clinical things that happen and why they happen, and then like worrying about how I'm communicating with athletes. Like there's so many other questions of, are you good with blank before, mm-hmm. are you good with your hands? Because like in where I come from, it's like in the manual therapy realm and everything we understand from the research, even the person that was, you know, 7-8 miles down the road, Chad Cook, who does a ton of manual therapy research at Duke University. Like he's had debate podcasts with a guy who's polar opposite on the other side of the spectrum, like Adam Meekins. But he even admits, and even in that paper that was published in 2024, I believe last year, the big manual therapy and how to implement it into modern practice. I mean, Chad Cook was one of the lead authors. And so someone who does a ton of manual therapy, who has invested, you know, decades of their career into researching manual therapy, even he admits that like, yeah, the specificity of the manual therapy, the technique that you choose probably doesn't matter very much. And that all of these like very clinician focused and centered manual therapy approaches of it does this or it does that, and this is why we do it, probably has no bearing. And that's not borne out in the research. And you can pretty much do any number of things so long as it kind of fits the person's preferences. So it's like, if you're asking if I'm good with my hands, like you really should just be asking, am I good at just listening to people and what they feel like they need? Because it doesn't matter what I do with my hands or some tool or some cup or some needle. It doesn't matter. And it's just interesting how the perception is. And this is taught in PT schools as well. And, you know, that, and I would say the everything has to be like this really specific, like pseudoscientific, you know, very hierarchical thing where, you know, we're these professionals and we wear these white coats and you should call us doctors and we should have these, you know, really cool things that can fix you. And it, the whole clinical setting, because of how it's set up, is based on the premise around that you're coming to see us that we can fix you. I mean, already at the outset of what a PT offers and is to society is already flawed, because we're not fixers. You know, we're not just the operators where you just come to us and we just do an operation on you and now you're fixed. It's way
Yeah.
more complicated, and it's about building these lasting relationships, having long-term health implications, and helping people navigate and manage through a space while we're giving them some help, because most people don't do it well anyways, and that's okay. But I think in both the elite setting, it kind of felt like how I felt like in PT school, that I was just
Yeah.
some dumb meathead idiot that didn't know what the hell I was doing because I didn't talk about some oblique fascial sling and, you name it, some PRI breathing pattern. I mean, it was like I would ask an athlete, like, "Oh, what'd you do in the training room today?" And they would come and tell me, like, "Oh, they had me lay on my side and I blew into this balloon a bunch of times. Like, I don't really know what it did. I guess I feel a little bit better." And I'm like, "Sweet. So, like, do you just want to like take a nap and come back, because you'd probably feel better too? Like, we could do that." So things like that. And it was like, "Oh, I'm the dumb one because I'm going to have that same athlete that y'all are having lay on his side, breathing into a balloon and getting manual therapy done and dry needling everywhere and cupping all over him for the last hour. And I'm going to put him under a squat bar and we're going to do super slow tempo squats with some heel elevation to a predetermined depth today. And get up to about a 2 or 3 out of 10
Isn't
pain."
that funny? Because isn't that what the strength coach would want to do? I don't know, like you like low getting them under some load and like being intelligent about it and keeping them moving. Like it's such a weird, such like it seems so like it's wild to me. So
Well, I'll say strength coaches, when something becomes medical, and this isn't true for all strength coaches, but especially in an environment where from the top down, like from head coach down, there's such an aversion to anything that's painful or anything that's even whispers of injury or not being able to play. Like, they're so averse to putting any kind of load on an athlete because there's so much pressure. You imagine like an NBA environment or an NFL environment, these guys are worth millions of dollars and they're telling you, "Yeah, this doesn't feel great." Like, "Well, okay, like I'm not gonna do that then." Even though in my eyes, like, some of that, it doesn't feel great, but I can tolerate it, is probably good. Like, that's actually like, and you could pull up numerous clinical research papers that indicate, even our clinical practice guidelines for the entire profession indicate that we should probably be doing some of these things for stuff like tendon loading. But yet you go into these settings and they're worth millions of dollars and there's just such an aversion to load, and it's scary all of a sudden that no one does it. And so, like, when somebody like me comes in and it's like, "Nah, fuck it. Like, we're gonna do these things." It's like, "What? You're crazy." Like, and maybe it's just because I had like a young face as well or something like that, but it was like, "Oh, there's no possible way this, like,
You're also a
what?"
pretty jacked athletic looking dude, So like there's like some this meathead.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, "Oh, this guy, there's no way he knows what he's doing. Like, he's just coming in here, guns a blazing, wild, wild west, clearly." And it's like, "No, this is actually good clinical practice, and there's a lot of research to back it up, but I'm just more informed than you are, and now I'm the idiot." So it was like, I just didn't like that. I didn't like feeling like every day I went to work, I just had to be very handcuffed. I had to silence my opinions. All of my best ideas were just kind of pushed under the table. I felt like, a lot of the things that I saw happening in front of my eyes that were like clearly mismanaged athletes and like poor rehab, you just have to take it and you just have to accept it. Like, "Yep, this is all just how this is, and there's nothing you can do about it." And so I was pretty sick of that, given I felt like I just had way more to offer, and I couldn't offer it there.
Well, I mean, there's so much to like one of my biggest things is just we as a society have completely misinterpreted pain as like a as you know part of a the human experience, but also just as a like pain is complex. We like know that. We can get into that a little bit, but like it's also just it's a response. Your thoughts, beliefs, expectations about what's going on, your threat perception, all these things, right? And I think my 6-month-old is like just screeching upstairs, so if you hear that, I'm sorry, but like so much of it is like we went we the pendulum swung too far from pain is weakness leaving the body to like now we must completely like, you know, and our medical system treats pain as like, it's just so wild. Cause I worked on a neurosurgery floor before PT school, and I was just exposed to people having laminectomies and coming in for repeated laminectomies. And like, and you know, the underlying thing with a lot of these people, and I'm sorry to say it, is like, these people just were not healthy. They were not active. They had extreme amounts of stress, a lack of understanding what was happening to their body. And our medical system in a lot of ways is just, well, this is what we can do from an operational or medical standpoint to manage this. The problem is like, yeah, part of it is just learning to manage the painful experience yourself. Like I'm reading like Dopamine Nation right now by Ann Lemke. And she just talks about like part of the management of anxiety is just learning to be mindful of what's making you anxious, stepping back from it and being okay and accepting some of it. Right. And like the science on pain is pretty much the same. Right. But in that setting with, again, players worth millions of dollars and, you know, and their preferences matter. And, but they also just don't understand, right? Like they don't get that. Yeah. Like, yeah. Like you look at what you did on the court. It kind of makes sense that your knee hurts based on the amount of load that we're like that you're putting through it on a regular basis. And like how we manage that is actually better training off the court and like either building you up or decreasing the stress on you on the court for a period of time until like things come back up. Right. And that's like, if we could have that conversation, it'd be awesome, but you kind of can't. Right.
Yeah. It's really difficult too. And I'm glad you brought up some anxiety and psychological stuff and even reflecting on some of your experiences on the neurosurgery floor. It's I've been seeing a psych therapist for 3 years who's a very existentialist and very into philosophy and Nietzsche and has just exposed me to a wide array of philosophy, really. And you know, in that realm, it's amazing to me just how frequently the conversations around emotions, around anxiety, depression, sadness, anger, anything like that is almost identical to how high-level clinicians talk about the pain experience and how we manage it. And you're right. I think that, you know, some of these surgeries or some of these interventions that the medical community is able to provide, there are times where that kind of is that last ditch effort, or people need something to get them out of such a deep hole that, you know, it's like they need some momentum, and maybe for some, you know, that is the only option, or at least the option that they feel most comfortable going forward with at that time in their life. So I understand that. But by and large, the medical community panders to these like very already folks that don't have a high level of health literacy.
Yeah.
Right. And athletes as well, like athletes don't have a high degree of health literacy. Their only their only input of what their health consists of is from whatever the athletic trainer or whatever doctor is giving them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you talk about like, well, a lot of these professional athletes maybe come from lower socioeconomic statuses that they didn't even get exposed to some of the stuff, or even if they came from a higher socioeconomic status, their family was just as, you know, athletic or lack of health literacy as well, that just kind of fed into whatever other athletes were doing. And so it just kind of continues to roll. And if we never come in from both an athletic standpoint, as well as just a population level, general population level standpoint, and really try to make an impact on non-communicable diseases, these chronic diseases, and trying to change our health literacy at large by communicating to these people exactly what you said about like, yeah, there's a certain amount of load. This amount of load, you know, you're not tolerating this amount of load. We probably can. Here's the right entry point. Here's where this is going. No, you're not damaging this structure more every time you feel a little bit of discomfort. Here's some other management strategies of diet, nutrition, and sleep and stress management. Like, there's so many other avenues to explore before you go in with a scalpel. But people just think like, oh, it hurts, so you need to fix it. And if you just do this thing, it'll no longer hurt. And it just doesn't pan out that way. Like, very rarely. I mean, I think there's like three pretty big studies with thousands and thousands of people in the cohorts where they investigate, you know, what are the effects of surgical interventions for all kinds of things, whether that's back, shoulder, knee, ankle, hip, neck, and how does it pan out with surgery versus non-surgical and conservative approaches? And it seems that surgery really doesn't have very much of effect, if any at all, despite having a pretty, you know, non-negligible amount of risk associated with doing the surgery and the sequelae of what happens after surgery of being more inactive. So I think there's huge gaps and flaws and problems in our medical system. And it's probably highlighted pretty well in the elite athlete population, especially with the status that comes with it. And now you look on TV, remember with the whatever Olympics that was, I think it was like 2008 or maybe 2012, but they were like, you know, looking at, you know, people with all the cupping marks all over them.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Phelps, you know, with all the cup marks, and people on the volleyball courts with the kinesio tape. And pretty soon it was like, oh man, you know, whatever the athletes are getting, that's the kind of care I need. They're getting the best stuff. Well, I want what the best stuff is. And it's like, no. Athletes don't get the best care. Athletes probably get some of the worst care.
They probably get some of the worst. Yeah.
Yeah. Athletes are getting like these really, patchwork, just kind of like, well, we don't know what the fuck to do, so just slap this thing on because, you know, so and so Michael Phelps said he's swimming today, so we don't know what the hell to do because he's got to swim like today or tomorrow, so clearly there's no time to prepare any more than he is now. What's something that we could just slap on this mother trucker and get him like to swim today? Like that's literally like the clinical rationale that's happening. And yet people on the outside, or even athletes who are just in the middle of their season, not at the Olympics competing that day for a gold medal, you know, they want all of these modalities and these treatments and these things because of the status that comes along with it. And it's sad. And unfortunately, a lot of healthcare providers, and especially athletic trainers, in the health, you know, world of elite sport, you know, they provide that stuff and think that they're doing good care because that's just what's done. And it's like, yeah, this is terrible.
Well, it just, we've done a few things, right? We've overlooked physiology. I love America. I love the United States. I don't want to turn this shit into and you do too, obviously. I was just scrolling down to your bobsledding picture, and I want to talk about bobsledding stuff in a little bit. But we also have this Protestant work ethic mentality, and it just lends itself to survivorship bias and not a lack of, I mean, I look around and even myself, like, you know, I work a lot. Like, I love what I do, and I like how I work is very different. I'm not constrained into like a 40-hour week, but that also means I often work like 50 plus hours doing just God knows what. And I'm constantly thinking, like, I have a headache right now, and it's pretty much because I spent all day yesterday just ruminating on a problem that I'm working on, right? And it's like, I think that's what's going on. Maybe it's not perfectly like that. I'm probably just a little taxed and whatever, but like, I also, you know, it's your body's going to respond. I did read when I was going through my shit, I read The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. And like, that book is not perfect. None of these books are freaking perfect. They're one person's perspective and the story they want to paint, right? But that book really ingrained in me like, yeah, the body does keep the score. Like, you know, it's telling you what's up. And but we've just, that survivorship bias, like Michael Phelps, and like he paid for it too. He paid for it after, and that's okay. Like Jordan, Mike, I love Michael Jordan, dude. Love him. He's paid for it. He has paid for the like mentality he developed in ways that were probably not advantageous if you just want to be a healthy, happy human who's just like able to go with the flow of stuff. And like, that's okay. That's like kind of the champion mindset, right? But, I just always go back to, have you ever seen Batman Begins? Like the first, like the guy in the beginning, the crime boss, like he's like, you know, people always fear what they don't understand. And like you're talking like Nietzsche, and like, I love shit. I was a history major in philosophy in undergrad. And I'm like, that we need more of that. But also like when you talk about that with people, like, what the fuck are you talking about? Yeah. Right. But it's people don't understand their pain. They don't understand the symptoms, and they don't understand like, yeah, I have a client right now, love her. She was just struggling with, she's super busy. And I'm like, well, you know, like, can you start running? Like, cause running is like such a low barrier entry, but I'm like, you got to start easy. Day one goes ham. And like, like she's like, my back of my knee hurts. And I'm like, yeah, because you just went hard on your first run of the year. And it's just like you, so people, and she is not thinking about it the way me and you would think about it. She's like, what did I tear? What did I break? What is wrong? And I'm like, no, like you're gonna be okay. We just have to dial things back, and we it's you know, it feels better when she moves, but it gets stiff really fast. Okay, I'm like, okay, like this is either some a little bit of a tendon thing or some muscular, probably a combination of both type of thing. We'll figure it out. But like the fact that it feels good when you're moving is good, right? But she's just focusing on like, oh shit, it stiffens up. What did I do? And like, is this gonna be okay? And like that's the type of stuff it's and again, that's why me and you have jobs. Right, like it's because we've dug into this stuff and like we're willing to think it through, but you know an athlete, you know who's gonna play a shit ton. It's figuring out how to communicate like what is actually helpful, what is mostly just like placebo like effects. Which have you ever listened to Hidden Brain, the A Dramatic Cure, that podcast? I think Derek Miles put that out. Actually, I think somebody from Barbell Medicine actually is who introduced it to me, but.
Right.
It was just like, yeah, oh shit. It's the drama of the situation that we love. It's the I have the cups on me. I have the machine on me. And even like I don't really know. I don't have the legs, like the compression things. What are those called? You know the game
Normatec boots.
Normatec. Like I don't have those. I'm probably never gonna get them. I'm sure they feel cool and I'm sure I would enjoy putting my legs in them. But like that's probably most of it. Like there's some benefit to compression, right? So anyway, but yeah,
Yeah.
it's just the drama of the endeavor, right? That people get wrapped up in.
Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing that up. And just to hammer in a couple more philosophy points, Byung-Chul Han wrote a book called The Burnout Society. And then he also has another book called The Palliative Society. And both of the ideas that come from these two books are things that we're actually talking about a lot right now, where in The Burnout Society, it talks a lot about the achievement society, this idea that like we almost create problems to solve because it feels good to
Yes.
solve problems. And that happens a lot in rehab and care that we want to like diagnose, we want to say things are tight, we want to say things need fixing, because then we in our back pocket have this fix, right? We have
Yeah.
this thing that can make that thing feel better. So now we created a problem to solve it, which makes us look awesome, but doesn't really help the person all that much. And it's kind of like in society, like we get, this idea of like busyness and achievement and how many little things can we, stack up. And even he even goes as far into talking about certain aspects of like religion, how sometimes like even creating things like scripture study or prayer, are these things that like we're adding to our plate, we're adding more work because it feels really good to achieve it, to check that off the list, to say I'm a good person because I checked this
Yeah.
box. I went to church, which I created this thing
Yep.
to add to my, level of stress, but as long as I do it, then it feels good to do it. And so it's kind of exactly what you're saying, where we create these like big dramatic scenarios, these things that have to be done, because then by doing it, it seems like we're making progress,
Yeah.
even though it doesn't actually hammer on any of the physiological properties or the rehabilitative properties, the long-term success and outcomes that we know happen through a good loaded movement-related or person-centered rehab program. But doing these modalities feels like we're checking boxes of a problem that needs to be solved. And then the palliative society talks about our aversion to pain, that we've become in westernized culture and society this model that like pain is bad, all discomfort is bad, and then we try to avoid it at all costs, right? We try to, exactly like the person you described, or I ran too much, I did too much too soon with too little time to recover, and now this pain, which is not thought of as just a result of doing too much and I need to pull back and I need to kind of find a better entry point, work my way through this. It's now, oh my gosh, pain is really bad. Pain means something's wrong. Fix my pain, do it. And it's this never-ending cycle and loop that we then ingrain into culture and society across all things. And yet when you ask people about their most impactful, meaningful life experiences, the things where they learn the most from, a lot of the times, a lot of these stories and anecdotes are surrounded with some pretty hard things and some painful and uncomfortable stuff. I think any, you know, rehab provider would say that they probably grew the most in their career, just like we started this whole podcast off with talking about existential crises. I mean,
yeah,
those were very uncomfortable moments that then led to a greater outcome and the value that we're able to provide to our clients as care providers has improved because of those things. And yet we somehow have gained this aversion to running from pain at all costs. And so you're right. That's why we have jobs, but I would love it if my job had a starting conversation point of, I hurt. Can you help me know what to do about it?
Yeah.
I think there is a way. I know that there must be a way that I can, you know, work through this and work through it, not just fix my pain, but I think there's a way that I have a way out of this. I would love if that was our starting conversation versus we have to convince people that it's okay to move, that no, if something is not torn, no, you don't need this huge medicalized care. No, you probably don't need an MRI given what you're telling me. You know, and so you're right. We have jobs because of this stuff. I would just love if the conversation point started a little bit further down that road, because it's like crazy how low level we have to start and take years to finally be touching on healthy habits. And it'd be like, yeah, you've had this and everybody has this, where they have these clients that come in and they're just like, they're beasts, man. They've been training for years. They have a swath of movement literacy, as well as a go do it attitude that they're like, no, man, like I just need some help figuring this out and like modifying my program. Dude, those clients,
they're awesome.
Are killers.
Yeah.
And like they're going to have good outcomes. Even if it takes a while, they're going to continue to move towards their goals. They're going to be super motivating for you and for everybody else around them, like good energy.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's not always going to be easy. Like sometimes like they're going to have really hard stuff, but like their mentality around it is so much more enjoyable to work with. And I think that if we as a society and healthcare providing kind of culture can have more of these messages and, you know, basically inundate our society and propagate these ideas versus the very old, outdated, old guard, biomechanical, patho-anatomical, over-medicalized, fix it, aversion to pain type stuff, I think we can have very so much better high level conversations and clinical outcomes than what we're doing right now.
You're 100% right. And I like sometimes the egotistical or the fearful part of me is like, well, shit, if everybody like figures it out, then like, I'm not going to have a job. But like our goal as a healthcare practitioner should be to put ourselves out of business, quote unquote. And then you just have to trust that. Like one of my favorite books is Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. And in Siddhartha, basically the whole point is that wisdom cannot be taught. And this is probably the biggest, this is an also hard part about this, is like people have to go through their own journey and then like be ready to learn the lesson, right? And so the people you're talking about, like who are, they have movement literacy, you know, they've been exposed to Greg Knuckles, they've been exposed to barbell medicine. You know, a lot of times, like I got a guy who, as on my roster, he got into lifting and he just freaking loves it. And his biggest problem is he doesn't auto-regulate very well. And the utility of a coach is not to fix anything or do anything really magical. It's just to be like asking him good questions and modifying his program so that he just doesn't, like, I really like, you know, I'm not a great powerlifter. I'm not really great at any of this stuff. I just love to train. But the biggest thing I see in like the powerlifting world is like people just go too hard, too long without any amount of like variation or variability to just let themselves kind of, you know, deload, so to speak, and develop different qualities and then level up. Like, cause like if, you know, if Mike Teixeira is the evidence of anything, it's just like, you can powerlift for freaking ever and keep getting super strong. It's just, can you be patient and play the game really well? And like, that's what it is cool when people are like that, when they like, you know, he doesn't really have an ego other than his ego is really positive in that. Like, it's just, I want to get better. Right. But that's the type of mentality. And the other person, like, The Little Black Book of Training Wisdom by Dan Cleather. Like, rule number one is be consistent. Rule number two is don't do anything that affects your consistency. And that's just, okay, so what's the long-term goal? But also, like, where are we at right now? And how do we make adjustments? And you're so right. And that's why I appreciate your content. I'm just like, I just always am scrolling people's pages while I'm talking. But, like, you're trying to put forth messaging And you do a really good job. I pretty much just like when you post like story, like research, I just go look at that. And like, that's how I stay up to date on research now is like you and a couple other people. I'm like, all right, I'll just go see what they're talking about. But yeah, it's being okay with leaning into the uncertainty of like, you know, there's a lot of these things that you're in so much of social media, so much of the current landscape is just people saying that this is how you get out of pain. This is XYZ. And it's like, there's actually a shit ton of options. Like when I talked to Greg Lehman came on and he's like, there's just a ton of options and that's okay. Like if you want to be a kettlebell coach, you can be a kettlebell coach and help people get out of pain. If, you know, even if he's like, I will admit that if you want to be a manual therapist, you can get people out of pain, but you have to just, you know, the narrative can't be about you. You talked about clinician centric manual. And like, that's where I differ. Like, and it's like, I haven't done manual therapy since I started my business. I haven't touched a person really, other than maybe to cue a few people in person, for 4 years. And I've helped a lot of people get out of pain. And it's like, okay, so what's that about? Right. And yeah, but like your messaging and optimism and the fact that like, yeah, these are, it's the dopamine, there's a balance that we have to strike, right? That's why when we train, you know, like so many days, I just don't feel like going in there. But then like I get on the bike and I start warming up and I start and I'm like, oh, I feel freaking great. Right. And it's because like it's just more complicated than like motivation or anything like that. It's like this balance of when you do challenging shit, you feel good. And like you put yourself through some quote unquote discomfort and you start to feel comfort. And that's like literally kind of allostasis in action, right? It's like us like finding a set point. And like once we get, I think we don't even have to get to there with people. I just think we need to get to the point where, like you said, it's I want to move. I have this pain. Help me understand it so I can keep going type of mentality. That like if we get to there as a society, I'm more optimistic, right? Hopefully we get there, right?
For sure. Yeah. Which you're talking about with Siddhartha, you know, kind of is reminding me of like Socrates, the Socratic method, right?
Yeah.
Like that you're not gonna teach somebody how to do all these things, that you kind of have to like slowly pull it out of them. Like that wisdom has to be like gained through their own personal experience. And like all the wisdom that they need is probably already inside them.
Yeah.
You know, they already have all the answers. It's just like a process of helping them find. And it's funny that you led with that riff about that, because that's exactly what I think a lot of really good psych therapy is. If we talked
Yeah.
about like what, you know, helping someone through even like a suicidal episode or depressive episode or anxiety, it's not somebody coming in and just like flipping your switch
Fixing.
and like
Yeah.
fixing your brain. Like, let me just give you this special tool that will just click your brain over and now you're fixed forever. It's a process of bringing all of this out of you, of acknowledging what things are causing this. Why am I feeling this way? Who am I really at the core? And like, I think that same kind of thing happens with pain and movement. It's like, you know, you have to experience certain things. You have to expose. I think, and I really appreciate you bringing up Greg Lehman as well, because he's dead on. And I think a lot of younger clinicians, even older ones that have had systems and algorithms and protocols, get really averse to, you know, the, all of a sudden this uncertainty and this idea of like total freedom that you could do anything. And they're like, what? Like, you can't just do anything. Then like, what's the purpose of all these clinical or continuing education courses? And what's the purpose of my career then if anything works? Like, it just becomes very like absurdist or like
Yeah.
nihilistic almost, of like nothing I do matters then. And it's not so much that, you know, it's that because a lot of things work, then you can work with a lot of people, you
Yeah.
know. And I've worked with a lot of folks that are runners, worked with exactly what you said, very you know, a kettlebell centric folks. And like, I'm down. Like,
Yeah.
if that's how you want to move and you really enjoy that, like that's a great place that we can at least start with that, versus having a conversation of, well, have you ever exercised? You know, it's like, I don't care how you move or what you
Yeah.
do or what kinds of things you engage with, whether you're a power lifter, Olympic weightlifter, just a general gym trainer, a bodybuilder, a functional movement pattern, whatever it might be that you're into. Like, we can mess with that and find ways that are, you know, meaningful. But I think just to circle, and maybe this highlights some of my bias, but I hope that this makes sense in a non-biased way and just gives a zoomed out picture that I do agree with you when you say manual therapy you can be a manual therapist and get a lot of success. You can get people out of pain. I think what you then have to shoulder the responsibility of is a lack of movement, and that if that individual is not also incorporating a ton of other healthy movement based and other things that will impact their long-term, you know, health as far as chronic disease goes, then the manual therapy side of things really misses a huge mark. And that's, you know, I think people argue all the time in the elite, going back to elite sports or working with active, really active populations, that, you know, they'll say like, oh, well, you know, these people already are hammering on all of these physical activity guidelines. They're already getting the resistance training. They're maybe even training too much. You know, they're overdoing it. So we have to do manual therapy, because the last thing I can do in the clinic is do more movement on someone who's, and it's like, I understand that mentality, but you're also missing the part where you have to have deep conversations and help them discover how to manage their loads of what it is that they're doing. If you're saying that what they're doing is too much and what they do outside of your time in the clinic, why do you think that your time in the clinic is what needs to help and fix them? It's probably more about what happens outside your doors of the clinic that needs to be addressed to help and really, really quote unquote, fix this person. And there's plenty of PT visits where I'd say 90%, if not almost the entire visit with me, even in person, has just been conversation. That's totally fine, because if most of what we're doing is psychosocial, there's a bio part, but a lot of that bio part is happening in the hours and hours and hours and days outside of your time in the clinic, that like maybe the psychosocial part is actually the most important thing that we can do right now. And so, you know, I just think that if you do want to pursue a heavy manual therapy based course of care, or any, you just have to take responsibility and onus upon all the other implications and all the other things that are going on. And that if you give this person something that seems like this is the fix, and now I'm in the operating chair operating on you, and every time that you screw up on the psychosocial side, or you overdo training, or you don't manage your load well, or you do something that you know shouldn't have, you just have to come running back to me to fix it for you, and create this needy very like hierarchical, I think is probably the best way that I deem it, because now I'm this person with this white coat and I have these expertise, and you need me to fix you. You need me in your life. My presence in your life is to just, you know, take care of you, just to make you feel better. And it's like, I get that that feels really good for a clinician, right? It feels awesome to be that person, to just come in with a knight in shining armor and, you know, make somebody feel better. And they came in hurting and they left thanking you, and I feel so much better. Like, that feels good. But if it keeps happening over and over again, did you really do your job? You know? And I think that, some of it's okay, but I think that, you know, we create these narratives and these problems and these dichotomies in society of I'm the clinician, you're the patient, and you have to, you know, instead of having like an equal, you know, some equality or some equity across our relationship together, where we're now meeting on the same playing field and working together to get your health up to a new standard versus, you know, I'm down here and I just need you to keep helping and fixing me. This, if that makes sense, what I'm saying.
It's 100% a vicious, because it doesn't actually, it only helps in so long as you can create the dependency, right? It's like a dependent relationship. And, it serves your ego in a way. Like, I think it's okay to have a healthy ego associated with wanting to help people. But part of wanting to help people, I would just always go back to, there was a kid in my class growing up. His mom did all of his homework for him. And then, like, you get to a certain point, and that kid, like, in high school was not functioning. Like, it could not function, right? And it was like, that's the same thing in my brain to some extent, right? Like, it, maybe not that extreme, but, like, it is what we're ultimately trying to do. And it's crazy, man, because like I'm coaching people, and like some people, are you just like a trainer? I'm like, I don't care. Like, they value the experience, they value the relationship that we've built to help them keep moving forward. And that's really cool to me, right? Like, and it's a non-dependent relationship. And I think that's like, that's the thing that you want to try to move towards, right? And it's hard, and it's not the same as, you know, being really confident in like your hands or being in person and XYZ, but like, man, it's having an awesome conversation with somebody that helps them move forward is really, really awesome, right? And
Well,
it's,
and real quick, just when you were talking about that, the am I just a trainer? I think Greg Lehman actually put out some really good stuff, and I can't remember if it was in a, I think it was in a podcast, I believe, where he's talking about how a lot of the strength and conditioning principles and like the reps and the sets and the intensities, sometimes in PT or, you know, a rehabilitative setting, you know, even though we're loading and we're following, you know, movement stuff, our reps and sets and RPEs and intensities don't match what you would normally see in strength and conditioning. It's very different for a reason based around that person's psychology, around their training history, around what's going on. Like, we may do things way differently in that setting, even though it is kind of, you know, movement-esque and looks similar. And so I think that therein lies a lot of the critical thinking and the skill set that you possess is, sure, if someone just took a photo from a distance, that snapshot in time, and this person's, you know, under a barbell, or this person's lunging, or this person's, you know, running or something, and you're there with them, yeah, sure, it just looks like strength and conditioning coaching. But knowing the why and the when and the how and how to tweak it based on what this person is telling you and their mentalities, like, that's what makes a good coach clinician, not just, yeah, we're just throwing you under weight. So just, I wanted to, you
that's
mentioned
a great
that,
point.
And I just wanted to say that there is a tremendous amount of clinical skill that comes from being something that looks from a distance like a strength coach. There's a tremendous amount of clinical reasoning happening in the background that's different from just purely strength and conditioning coaching.
That's a great point. And I like, my first experiences in the weight room were just like so non-adaptable to kind of like the needs of the athlete in high school. Like, they were just like, here's the stuff you do, right? And some kids are going to, you know, do fine, competent. Like, I was like athletic, but I wasn't like a great mover, I guess is the best way to put it. So like, you put a barbell on my back, and I'm just like a gazelle. Like, I'm like a zebra who's like on skates. Like, I just didn't know how to do it. And you know, even just like, hey, you can squat to this box and get like, but that's the type of critical thinking, like, that shit compounds, right? And it builds confidence. And like, that's a really good point. Like, there's so much that you can think through and you can help people. It's just being a good teacher in a lot of, in my opinion, for sure. All right, I want to talk about bobsledding. How did you get in? Like, I know this is a big pivot, but I want to respect your time and talk a little bit about your athletic. So did you play lacrosse? Like, what sports did you play growing up?
Yeah. Oh God. I mean, growing up, I played every sport. I mean, I did everything, like boxing. I did, I'm trying to think of like niche stuff. I mean, did like all the martial arts, like a lot of karate and taekwondo and boxing. I wrestled, I played soccer, baseball, I did swimming. I did all of lacrosse, football. I'm trying to think, what am I missing here?
Did you run track?
Basketball. I ran track in junior high.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot of sports that I didn't at least give a try for a year, you know, if not longer. And I participated in a lot of different stuff growing up, but then it kind of filtered down into mostly football and lacrosse later on in high school, to mostly just lacrosse beyond high school and into college. So yeah, I played college lacrosse and was
fortunate. Where'd you play?
Enough. What was that?
Where'd you play college lacrosse at?
Yeah, so I started at Brigham Young University in Utah. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah. So Brigham Young University at the time was like the best MCLA lacrosse school. And that was kind of like, if you were from Utah, you know, you were kind of like confined to the walls of Utah. Like, no one from Utah was going and playing like really anywhere else. And so BYU was kind of like the pinnacle, and it was great. You know, I mean, like, first year there, we won a national championship for the MCLA, and, you know, all of my time there, we had conference championships and things like that. So very high level in the MCLA. And then I played at University of North Carolina. So after BYU, and I finished my undergrad very quickly and did like summer classes and things like that. So finished very fast. So I had a lot of eligibility left. So when I started grad school, I went to University of North Carolina, and I played there at the University of North Carolina as well. National champions and conference champions. So again, like extremely fortunate to just be falling into really, really high level lacrosse and great teammates and just great years. So I had great experiences playing lacrosse, and yeah, it was great. And then I would just like train with the football team here and there, and football players outside of lacrosse time. And it was just always something that kept my physicality up really high, and really enjoyed training. So then talking about lacrosse, talking about bobsled, I had a strength and conditioning coach that was a GA, who was a little bit older, but he was at UNC, and he had done bobsled in the past years ago. And he just was like, dude, you're really good at pushing sleds. Cause he did a lot of that with lacrosse, and he was like, you know, you kind of have the right size, a lot of the right build. You might be really interested or good at doing bobsled. Have you ever thought, you know, cause you know, playing lacrosse at that time, you know, post-college, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it wasn't really a career move. Like, you're not going to go make a bunch of money doing that. And I probably wasn't even good enough to do that anyway. So it was kind of like, well, that option is closed, but I would still love to compete. And so he offered this like bobsled thing, and growing up in Utah and, you know, 2002 Winter Olympics being there, I actually went and saw bobsledding and thought it was awesome. And had even said years before, like 3 years before this had happened, that I might love to do bobsled one day. And so when he said it, it was just like huge sparks went off in my brain. I was like, hell yeah. So yeah, I just started training, pursued it. I went to a combine, which is like, you know, just testing grounds. I basically how it worked was I was training in North Carolina. I got accepted to PT school, moved to Utah to go to PT school. And like 2 weeks later, found out that there was this like combine. So literally moved. And then in 2 weeks, went to this combine, was like kind of underprepared for it. And just like in the swaths of, or the sway of moving and about to start PT school in like a week from then.
Yeah.
And I went to this combine, did really well at it. Like I finished in the top like two or three guys at the combine, and they invited me to come out to rookie camp. And I was like, well, I'm starting PT school in about a week, so I guess I'll see you in like 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what happened. I just all through PT school, I sprinted and lifted a ton and just did the best I could to keep my fitness level really high. And the moment I graduated PT school, I tried out again at another combine, did well, got invited to a rookie camp, competed at the rookie camp. Basically how it works is they take you up to Lake Placid, New York. They show you how to push a sled. And then you have 1 week to get good at pushing the sled and getting in. And then you compete against all the other rookies, and just kind of a feeling of like winner takes all, like whoever wins gets to, you know, come back. And so, did really well at the rookie camp. I won my rookie camp. And so I got invited to come back and competed, did push championships, and ended up getting a spot on the national team, which is like, that's the highest you can go. And bobsled is, you're a member of the USA national team. And then they select from the USA national team every quad, every 4 years. That's who, you know, they select a team or two sleds, depending on how many bids you get from your NGB, you get to go to the Olympics out of the national team. So that was a really awesome experience, something I'm considering doing again in the future. But yeah, it was a ton of fun and different, very niche sport, very weird environment up there in middle of nowhere, like Placid, New York. I mean, it's, you are up there, dude, like 3 hours away from the closest airport and Canadian border, and it's just middle of nowhere feelings, and you're just up there to train.
Yeah, dude, that's awesome. That's an awesome journey. So like, okay, when's the next Winter Olympic? We just had the summers, right?
2026.
So is there like a cycle where you could potentially try to make the team in the not too distant future?
So I would come in right after the Olympics. Right after the 2026 Olympics. So they're in Milan, Italy, but the actual bobsled event will be held in Lake Placid, at least as of right now. That's the plan.
Really?
Is that Lake Placid has become the site for bobsled and skeleton, and I believe luge then as well will be there. So because Milan, they had a big slide track that they were thinking about repairing, but they opted not to. So they're going to leave that in disrepair and just hold the the sliding events in Lake Placid as part of the Milan, Italy Olympics.
Gotcha. Where do you, how old are you?
I'm 33.
33. All right. You're still young. I'm 36. Like, I, dude, I like, it's crazy. I just believe less and less in like age. Like, I believe in like, yes, like your ability to recover is going to slow down. And like, there's aspects of it that are very much real, but like so much of it is like, you know, I, it's just your attitude and learning to ride the waves and just enjoying training. So much of it is just the process orientation and enjoying like the fitness, the, you know, and while also not making it your whole identity, because that's another aspect of this is like, dude, just train hard and have fun and like then, you know, do other stuff. But like, where do you see your athletic pursuits going as you get older? Like, are you gonna keep competing in stuff? Do you feel, do you need that? Do you not care anymore? What is, where does that go for you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm kind of with you. Like, I think over the past, probably since the time I was like 26 or 27 up till now, I've like PR'd my vertical jump by an inch or two every year. So it's like, I don't see that age right now is this huge barrier where it's like, oh, it's all downhill from here. Like, yeah, there are things that I'm way better at now than I was a couple of years ago. Way stronger at certain things. I would say, like, even this week, like, I've 3 summers ago, I weighed 250 and was just real thick, a lot of lean tissue mass, but I was very strong, not as fast. This week I weighed in at 220. I'm down to 220, which is great for me, but I was just warming up squatting the other day and just ripped 405, like easy at 220. Yeah. And that, before, like, I'm not a good squatter. I could actually probably lunge 405 just as easy as I could squat it, to be honest. I'm like a really strong unilateral, semi-unilateral like lunger. But, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, like, strength hasn't really gone down much. If anything, it continues to go up, and speed on the track, like, feel just as capable. You know, I mean, I feel like I could probably go out today and run a 4:06:40, like, pretty easy, you know, like, that seems like well within the means of what I could do. Like, and most bobsledders, honestly, like, they're in their mid to late 30s. So I guess, you know, to that point, I'm kind of like, yeah, as long as I'm managing training loads, kind of like the Mike Tashier thing, like, I don't have an ego around it. It's just that, like, I'm really positive that, like, dude, I think we can actually do a lot more later into our 30s. It's just that most people don't, you know. I think that, what was that crazy statistic in 2024 that came out with a paper that said, you know, people over the age of 30, there was like less than 2% or less than 3% of people over the age of 30 will ever sprint again in their life.
That's wild. Yeah,
dude, what? Like, I sprint.
And sprinting's like, I'm not fast, dude. Like, my best 40 time as in high school was like 5 flat. But I've also, I just had people, and this was not because they were malevolent. They just like, they're like, you just have such a slow first step. Like, you're just so slow off the line, dude. Yeah. And I was a soccer player. I played football, but I played soccer. And I also just ran. I, like, how I was going to get fit is I just went and pounded the pavement. But I love sprinting now. It's been, I'm 36. I think you've been an influence on this. Like, Will Rattel's been an influence on this. Like, there's been a lot of people. It's just like, it's such a good stimulus. And yes, you have to condition yourself to it. Like, I played rugby again at 34, and I was way stronger, but I just moved like absolute garbage. And so I was just like popping calves in my hand, and I hurt my quad, and I'm like, all right, so you got to like actually go like condition. And I just think complementary, or, you know, what you want to call it, vertical training. Like, if you're just patient, it's so paradoxical, but the more patient you are, the more progress you make. Right. And it doesn't mean you don't push, but like on any given day, just take what's there. Again, Mike Tashier. And then when you just keep taking what's there over and over again, like, a lot of good stuff starts to be there. Right. And that's the cool thing about it.
100%, man. I want to praise you and also like just highlight that idea that you just talked about. Like, you know, you played rugby at 34 and all these things happened, but it didn't mean that you were like, oh, well, I'm just too old. I guess I just can't do this. Then I'm just not, man, my running days are over. It's like, no, dude, there's a way forward through this all that you manage it. And like, I've gotten faster since when I first started training sprinting. I mean, I probably was honestly like in that you know, really high fours, low fives, 40, even, you know, a year or two after finishing playing college lacrosse. I mean, I probably would be lucky to run like a 5 or a 4.9, you know, at that time. But like, I got so much faster just exactly by doing what you said, just taking what's there.
Years
of being frustrated at times and injured on the track, doing way too much or not knowing how to set up a training program. And like, you just kind of slowly learn over time. If you have this endless pursuit of, I'm not giving up on this thing, like good things can happen. And it doesn't, you know, yes, as you get older, sure, there's certain things that you have to take into account and life happens. And you know, you just talked about like, was it your 2-year-old upstairs?
My 6-month-old.
Oh, six-month-old, excuse me. So, you know, six-month-old up there screeching, you know, like, dude, you have kids, like life happens, work happens, all these things, but it doesn't mean that you just have to totally abandon all of these athletic pursuits. And people can do far more than they think they can with just some good training mentalities and things like that. So anyways, just, I love that you did that. It's awesome.
I think some of it is just, you start to, I don't want to say abhor, I abhor the narrative. I don't know if that's the right word, but like that, like just because you're getting old, like life is way better for me at 36 than it has ever really been. Right. And, you know, like, and I think life kind of gives you, so one of my favorite mantras is lessons will be repeated until they're learned. Right. And like me in the weight room, I was the kid, I've gotten a lot better at squatting, but again, like I said, my early exposure is like, you're so bad at this. And I would see my buddies who were pretty decent on it and just made me feel like shit. And then I just told myself for so long, I'm such a bad squatter. And I did everything. I did the mobility wad. I did, you know what I didn't do? You know what I didn't do, Q?
What's that?
Squat. I didn't freaking squat. I would avoid the thing that I wanted to get good at, right? And I tried to find every hack. And doesn't mean that single leg exercises and XYZ wouldn't help, but like I do the 30-minute warm-up and then I'd go get under the bar and I'm like, I'm still sucky. And it's like, and this is what I appreciate about people in our profession who are like suspending their ego and just being curious, right? And like, hey, what can I do? And that's because that's what it's about, right? And you know, yeah, like I posted the other day, like if all that I get out of my athletic pursuits at this time is less chance of metabolic disease, less chance of going into the hospital for anything, and less like going to the nursing home as late as possible, that's a pretty good outcome, right? I rolled the shit out of my ankle at basketball like 3 weeks ago. It's worst ankle sprain I've ever had. And it's like, but I'm still going to show up in basketball in a couple weeks. Like once this baby's healed, I'm not going to crash the boards as hard for a couple weeks, but I'm still going to go play. And like, that's what I want people to have the mentality. Just keep trying to play. Right. And so,
yeah,
I think you're on it. We'll have to come. I'll have you back in the not too distant future. I'll give you a little bit of time to cleanse your palate of this, but just talk about like training philosophy. We got into a lot of good stuff, rehab oriented, but I want you to go get up on with your day. But where can people find you, Coach Q?
Yeah, I mean, the best place is probably Instagram, just coach_Q_physio. Yeah, if you just comment on a post or DM me there, that's usually the best place to interact with me. There's, you know, podcasts like this. I mean, if you want to interact with any of the ideas that I put forth, you know, like stuff like this is great. You know, doing podcasts and things like that is awesome. But yeah, if people want to find me, that's typically the best place to go. I have a website, findphysiotherapy.com, that you could find me there as well.
All right. Coach Q, thanks so much for being on. Appreciate you. Have a good Tuesday.
All right, brother. Thank you.
Peace.